It is 5:30 in the morning on June 5th, 1288. The air in Brauweiler Abbey Church is cool and filled with the scent of incense. The only sound to be heard is the soft murmur of Siegfried von Westerburg, Archbishop of Cologne, echoing off the walls. He's hearing a final confession and celebrating a final mass. Silence still reigns. But outside, at dawn, thousands of knights are already waiting with their respective retinues. And in the confession he has just made, he confides to the listening priest that he is prepared to die today for the rites of the Church of Cologne. In a few minutes, Siegfried will give the order to set out. He would call out to his allies that the enemies there were waiting for them like a beached whale that had strayed into the Archbishopric of Cologne, with rich spoils for him and his allies. Their destination after setting out? Fühlingen, just 12 kilometers away. What begins so peacefully here will end in one of the most brutal and bloodiest battles between knights that this region has ever seen, the Battle of Vorringen. And with that, welcome back to the History of Cologne, a podcast about the history of the city of Cologne that is over 2,000 years old. But until it became what it is today, this old city on the Rhine has endured a colorful and rich past, hence it can therefore be seen as a microcosm of European history. In this podcast, you can listen as the city grows from the Romans up until our present time. So, buckle up, everybody. Today is finally the day we're diving into one of the key moments that changed Cologne's history forever. So, here we are at the Battle of Vorringen in 1288. We are able to reconstruct the battle and its participants relatively well, but where does this information actually come from? We owe it to a chronicler from Brabant named Jan van Helu, who in a likelihood witnessed the battle himself. Shortly afterwards, he wrote an account of the events of the Limburg War of Succession in over 9,000 verses. The second half alone, that is 4,500 verses, is devoted solely to the Battle of Vorringen. Of course, we should be aware that Jan van Helu was extremely biased in favor of his own side, namely Brabant, and yet his account remains the most important historical source of all on the subject. It is the only place where we learn more than just the outcome of the battle. How I would have loved to delve straight into this primary source. Unfortunately, I lack the time for such a thing. Producing a new episode every 3 weeks requires making some compromises, so unfortunately, I have only encountered him through the scholarly literature, which has cast him and his verses in the right light. And people, while I'm recording this, I have 37 degrees in my apartment room here. And I'm not talking about Fahrenheit degrees, but Celsius degrees. So the temperature of the human body is the temperature in this room. We have the worst heat wave I ever experienced in Germany. So, be kind, but now let's get on with the episode. What was the situation on 5th June 1288? The Limburg War of Succession began in 1283 following the childless death of Duchess Irmgard of Limburg and had already been dragging on for 5 long years. Two warring factions quickly emerged. The Limburg War of Succession rapidly developed into a fundamental power struggle between the two hostile camps. The Brabant coalition, led by Duke John I, who had adopted the claims of Count Adolf of Berg, fought alongside the Counts of the Mark, of Lodz, and of Jülich, and shortly before the battle began, also alongside the city of Cologne, for control of regional trade routes and against the archbishop's dominance. This bloc was opposed by the archiepiscopal faction, in which the Archbishop of Cologne, Siegfried von Westerburg, together with Count Reinhard of Geldern and the House of Luxembourg, sought to defend the position of the Cologne Church and halt Brabant's drive for expansion into the Lower Rhine region, or towards it, better said. After 5 years of grueling sieges without a military resolution, the conflict escalated when the customs fortress of Vorringen, north of Cologne, was besieged on 29th May 1288 by troops from Brabant, Berg, and the city of Cologne, which ultimately forced both sides into the decisive Battle of Vorringen on 5th June 1288. Thanks to Jan van Helu, we are able to trace the course of the battle relatively well in chronological order. As already mentioned in the introduction, the army of Archbishop Siegfried von Westerburg, the House of Luxembourg, and the Count of Geldern had spent the night of 4th to 5th June at Brauweiler Abbey. We've also discussed Brauweiler in more detail before, particularly Mathilde, a daughter of Theophanu, whom we adore here on the podcast really much, who co-founded the monastery towards the end of the 10th century. If you want to listen again to it, episode 43 is the way to go. Admittedly, Jan van Helu, the chronicler of the battle, does not specify any times in his account. However, a few clues do help us to determine the exact times as precisely as possible. We can assume that the Archbishop's Mass in Brauweiler Abbey was over by 6 a.m. or 6:30 a.m. at the latest. The vanguard of his army would then have set off, while Siegfried von Westerburg himself changed his clothes and donned his armor. He would not have been carrying everything directly on his person at this stage. His shield, lance, and helmet would have been transported on pack horses led alongside by him by his servants. So it is fair to say that by 7 o'clock in the morning, the Archbishop of Cologne was also ready to set off for Fühlingen near the city of Worringen, 12 kilometers away. To set off is the right term, the fitting term. The army's traveling speed was around 4 to 5 kilometers per hour. This means it would take around 3 hours to cover the distance of 12 kilometers. But as thousands of horses set off that day, along with their carts, the road to Fühlingen was packed. The knights alone, due to their sheer numbers, stretched for a length of 9.8 kilometers on that narrow road. This meant that by the time the first troops of the Archbishop arrived on the battlefield near Worringen to take up their positions, the rearguard in Brauweiler Abbey had not even set off yet. It therefore took a good 5 hours for the very last knight, the very last foot soldier, and the very last pack horse to arrive at Worringen. By then, it was around 11 o'clock in the morning. The Archbishop is confident of his victory. With 3,500 knights, he is far more than the opposing side, which fields only 2,400 knights. And since mounted warriors were the be-all and end-all of warfare at that time, Siegfried von Westerburg regards victory as already granted by God himself. He and his allies had previously commissioned the manufacture of hundreds of iron chains and shackles in the expectation of capturing a particularly large number of noble knights in the battle that day, and extorting ransom from their families, because they were going to win this battle, obviously. This was a perfectly normal practice at the time. A dead nobleman was of no use to anyone. He could no longer yield any ransom. When such a massive army sets out, it does not go unnoticed by the enemy. As the Archbishop's army, together with his allies from Luxembourg and Geldern, was forming up, they could already see in the distance, in the north, the army led by Brabant and his allies. Also present were the armed patricians from Cologne, along with their servants. We also know where the camp of the Count of Berg and Cologne's city troops was located. They were encamped in the middle of the so-called Worringer Bruch. The Worringer Bruch is a marshy flat plain on the banks of the Rhine, enclosed in a circle by a silted-up former branch of the river. 8,000 years ago, the Rhine still flowed here, before it carved out a new course, the one we see today. This provided the camp with immediate natural protection against approaching enemies. The troops and allies of the Duke of Brabant, meanwhile, were encamped to the north of this, outside the Worringer Bruch, from where they intended to lay siege to the Archbishop's fortress. For even whilst the battle was about to take place, some of Brabant's fighters would continue the siege of Worringen, the Worringen Castle. It is unimaginable that an attack from the north might come from there, striking the rear of the rest of the army in support of the Archbishop, who was advancing with his army from the south. You mustn't picture the battle formation as discussed in the last episode as everyone standing there in grey, dark and grubby attire. No, the knights in particular wore polished armor, for reasons of prestige, of course, but also to protect against rust. That's why you polish your armor. They, as well as the foot soldiers, wore colorful tunics in magnificent colors, for fashion's sake naturally, but also to distinguish friends from foe during the battle. These could be seen on the bodies, horses, and shields of the participants as well, and let's not forget all the coats of arms of the nobility. Even though they gathered to slaughter one another, it must have looked impressive. with around 6,000 colorful knights lined up here and a few thousand of foot soldiers as well. The Archbishop of Cologne has a simple coat of arms, a black cross on a white background. He has a particularly large flag bearing this design, flanked from a banner card, clearly visible to all his allies and enemies alike. The contingent of Cologne citizens marches into battle bearing an early version of what we know of the city's coat of arms that we still use today. The lower two-thirds is just plain white. And at the top, there's a red bar with three golden crowns. These, of course, represent the relics of the three wise magi, which can be viewed in the shrine within the unfinished Gothic cathedral in the city. The 11 flames or tears of Saint Ursula do not yet appear on the coat of arms of the citizens of Cologne. These were added later in the early modern period. Among the people of Cologne themselves, there are also a wide variety of coat of arms. The Cologne patricians, the families always emulating the nobility and knights, had meanwhile adopted their own coat of arms. Take the Oberstolzen, for example. The head of the family, Gerhard Oberstolz, leads his followers with a coat of arms featuring several yellow lions superimposed on one another, resembling the battlements of a castle on a red background. The troops of the Count of Berg fight under a red lion on a white background. The Duke of Brabant and his followers in turn have a golden lion on a black background. As a child, I had one of those wooden children's shields bearing the Brabant coat of arms. Really cool. I still believe I have it somewhere at my parents' house. All this splendor of colors and coat of arms is no longer something we can quite picture, especially in a purely audio format like a podcast. That's why I'd like to draw your attention to the miniature model of the Battle of Worringen, which you can see at Schloss Burg in Solingen, it's a castle, as part of the permanent exhibition in their museum there. I'll also be happy to post photos of it on the website. It's well worth a look. Thehistoryofcologne.com. In the last episode, we also looked at warfare in the 13th century, and above all at the fact that classic pitched battles, familiar from films and TV series, where two armies face each other directly and then kill one each other, were the exception. And yet, that is exactly what we have here, an open field battle. And yes, it was clear to everyone involved what was at stake here in a situation like this, but why did both warring parties decide to seek an open, direct clash after now 5 years of conflict? The reasons are easy to identify. This conflict, as I said, had already been raging for half a decade. Count Reinhard of Geldern, fighting on the Archbishop's side, had even sold his claims to the Duchy of Limburg to the Luxembourgs in 1288, as he simply could no longer afford the conflict financially. With the noble house of Luxembourg, a new, virtually rested opponent entered the fray in 1288. Duke John of Brabant and his allies were therefore seeking a swift resolution now, before the whole affair dragged on any longer or drove them, like Geldern, into ruin. The Luxembourgers did the same, seeing themselves at an advantage as guests who had only joined the party very late. Then there was the Duchy of Limburg itself. We are separated from all that by the passage of time, but we can no longer fully grasp the suffering that took place there due to lack of primary historical sources. Limburg itself was a sought-after goal. It was the jewel in the crown of a realm, well situated on long-distance trade routes such as roads and rivers between the Rhineland and wealthy Flanders, and Flanders being one of the most wealthiest regions of all in Europe. It had by now been severely devastated by the protracted conflict. If a decisive outcome to the conflict were not to be reached here soon, there would be soon nothing left for the victor to gain here in Limburg but scorched earth. This, too, forced both sides to realize that they had to try their hand at a direct clash after all. Then there is the topography of the terrain. We'll come back to that in more detail in a moment. The Fühlinger Heide, the Fühlinger Plain, offered plenty of flat land close to the Rhine River. For both sides, this meant that mounted troops could operate effectively here. Had either side perceived a disadvantage here for himself, the battle would not have been accepted by that side. It was therefore clear, both sides thought this battleground is good, a field battle would take place here today. Both sides formed up, adopting exactly the same formation as the other, as this was the standard formation at the end of the 13th century. You'll need a bit of a spatial imagination here. Armies didn't simply line up as solid blocks, but in three wings, a center wing, and a right and a left wing. Just imagine three rectangles side by side. Each of these wings was staggered to the back, towards the rear, into a total of three sections. That gives us a grid of rectangles with 3x3 from each wing. Initially, only the first section of each, whether center, right, or left, engaged the enemy. Behind them, the second and third sections held the positions ready to absorb any enemy breakthroughs through their own first section, or even to intervene as reinforcements during the course of the battle, or indeed to relieve, that is, to take over from the first section. The third section had the same tasks, only one row further back. This meant that at the start of the battle, as many as 2/3 of the deployed troops were not actively taking part in the battle at all, at least in theory. Who is deployed on which side and how? This is extremely interesting. Usually, the commander of the army is positioned with his troops on the center wing. This allows him to issue orders to both the right and left wings simultaneously and gives him the best overview. The Duke of Brabant, John I, does that. He stands in the center alongside the Limburg nobles who are on his side in this war succession. For the opposing side, too, has Limburg allies in its own ranks. On the right wing of Brabant stand the troops of Count Lodz and the Count of Jülich. The latter had only just switched sides to Brabant at the very last moment. The same applies to the citizens of Cologne. They serve as foot soldiers mainly on the left wing, alongside contingents from the county of Berg and Mark. And some patricians are on horseback as well, around 60. Since this is still a podcast about Cologne, despite the wider regional implications, let's focus a little more on the Cologne contingent here. Historical research suggests that 1,500 Cologne residents took part in the battle as fighters. Given a population of around 40,000, that's a great many Cologne residents who risked their lives there. The Bergish peasants, effectively the ancestors of the people of Düsseldorf, numbered around 500 men. And now, my friends, the obvious point which I simply must address here: people from Cologne and future Düsseldorf were fighting side by side here, not just on the same side, but even right next to each other. This is said to be where the famous rivalry between the two Rhineland cities began, but I don't believe that, however. Now, you might think that the people of Cologne were assigned a key role before the battle, given that they had so spectacularly sided with Brabant and betrayed their own archbishop and city lord Siegfried von Westerburg, but no, they were actually intended to play a very passive role during the battle. On the Fühlinger Heide, the Fühlinger Plain, they stand between the Rhine River and the center wing, thus protecting Brabant's main force from one side. The role assigned to them is purely defensive, to hold their position, be defensive, and let Brabant take the center. But perhaps you're familiar with the saying, any battle plan is only good until the first shot is fired, or in this case, the first crossbow bolt. Because for ordinary foot soldiers, the Cologne militias were really well equipped. Jan van Heel reports that they were all kitted out in chainmail, and I know there are few medieval enthusiasts listening here, no offense intended, but I know it's easy to put your foot in it when it comes to terminology. Still, I think everyone knows what chainmail is, hundreds of small iron rings woven together to provide protection. It wasn't always cheap. The wealthy citizens of Cologne could afford it out of their own pockets. The vast majority of Cologne's inhabitants would not have been able to do so, but they received the equipment at the city's expense. In the event of war, the city collectively stored its own weapons and armor in a storeroom, an armory. I mean, it's no wonder the city had this when you think of all the conflicts that had taken place in the last few decades alone. And yes, on the subject of crossbows, many Cologne residents owned crossbows. As a close combat weapon, everyone carried a pike, and those who could afford it also carried a sword. 60 Cologne patricians, that is, members of the noble families, were mounted and armored like knights. One of them was Gerhard Overstolzen, and we'll come back to him later. With the equipment and the constant training they received through tournaments, the Cologne patricians were certainly a match for the noble knights on the opposing side. Right, that was the Brabant lineup. Let's move on to the opposing side. Didn't I mention earlier that the commander of an army always positions himself on the center wing? Usually, yes, but Archbishop Siegfried von Westerburg chose a different approach. He took up position on the right wing with his forces, including his Westphalian and Rhenish vassals from the Archbishopric of Cologne, and thus found himself directly opposite the fighters from the city of Cologne, technically his subjects who had betrayed him. The real reason, of course, was that the Luxembourgers did not want to fight directly against Burgish troops, as the two noble houses were related. How extremely polite and civilized. Even though he was positioned on an outer flank, the Archbishop of Cologne made it clear that he saw himself as the center of his army. Well guarded, he led a large standard bearer's cart into battle. On it, his coat of arms flew from a flagpole. The coat of arms of the Archbishopric of Cologne, as I said, a black cross on a white background. You really must picture the standard bearer cart just like the floats you see in carnival parades these days. A small crenellated wooden castle had been built on a cart from which some of the Archbishop's men-at-arms also served. I'll put a picture of it on my homepage, thehistoryofcologne.com. In the center wing stood the Luxembourgs, that noble family which had only recently purchased the rights to the Duchy of Limburg from Gelder. Also related to the extinct House of Limburg, Limburg nobles fought alongside the troops here too. This would mean that Limburgers were facing each other as enemies on both sides in the center. It was here in particular that the fighting between the Limburgers was too especially fierce. The left wing consisted of the Count of Geldern and his vassals who had sold his former claim to the Duchy of Limburg to Luxembourg. So, the formation is in place. It is 11 o'clock in the morning and the battle begins. The right wing of Archbishop of Cologne makes the first move, advancing against units from the city of Cologne and the Count of Berg. Several roads crisscross the battlefield. Among them is the Roman road linking Cologne with Neuss. From a hill, today's Blumenberg, the Archbishop has a clear view of the Cologne infantry and spots a weak point in his enemy's ranks before him. If he manages to put the left wing to flight right at the start, the Archbishop could immediately turn towards the center and attack the Duke of Brabant by flanking him directly from the side. The battle would, in effect, be won. So the Archbishop sets off northwards with his knights. In doing so, they cross a road linking Fühlingen to Worringen, a local road. For whatever reason, the formation of the Archbishop's knightly army falls apart as they cross the road. Nevertheless, they continue at a trot. Yes, as I said, it's not like in the films where men and horses exhaust themselves completely during the charge, riding 1 kilometer or more. Only when the enemy is just 50 meters away does the Archbishop order them to gallop, and this terrifying onslaught of horses and armored knights crashes down upon the peasants, the foot soldiers from Cologne, and the peasants of Berg. Bear in mind that the Archbishop of Cologne already has around 1,000 knights of his own. Against them, the roughly 1,500 Cologne foot soldiers and 500 farmers from Berg stand virtually no chance against that charge. They suffer heavy losses and flee the battlefield northwards right from the start. Really, they flee. Well, I can't blame the Cologne foot soldiers. I wouldn't fancy being slaughtered like that either. Now you might think the Archbishop would mercilessly chase after them with his knights to kill every last soldier like you do in medieval Total War, but that would not be technically wise, as it is maybe in a computer game. For the deeper the Archbishop's army, that is the right wing, penetrates into this space occupied by the enemy's outnumbered left wing, the greater the risk that Siegfried von Westerburg will be flanked from the side by the enemy's center, the Duke of Brabant. So, the Archbishop of Cologne gives up the chase and does what he had intended all along. He abruptly stops charge and swings his forces to the left now to strike directly at the heart, at the center of the Brabant army. But now we must consider this again. They, his troops of the Archbishop, are all on horseback. Horses are fast and large. Turning 90 degrees to the left with 1,000 knights, just like that, is not so easy. So as a result, the Archbishop's knights, riding in close formation as advance, collide with their own allies, the Luxembourg knights in the middle, who were also just setting out to attack the enemy center. And as strong and dangerous as a single knight already is, the same principle applies here. Only in formation is one strong and effective as a knight. Yet the formation is now in complete disarray on the side of the Archbishop and the Luxembourgers in the center. Only the sheer numerical superiority of a Brabant is preventing defeat here. So, now it is 12 o'clock, and the main part of the battle is taking place in the center. The Brabant forces under Duke John I are maintaining their formation with discipline. Only in this way can they withstand the superior numbers of the enemy, Luxembourgers and the Archbishop of Cologne, who are charging at them in completely disarray. The right wing of the Brabant allies, consisting of troops from Lodz and Jülich, succeeds where the left wing, made up of men from Cologne and Berg peasants, had previously failed. They hold the line, thereby covering the flank of the Brabant forces in the center. The enemy's left wing, facing them, exerts no pressure whatsoever. On the contrary, parts of the Count of Gelder's army break ranks and leave the battlefield and ride around it, the battlefield, because they don't want to die. They prefer rather to loot the Brabant's now empty military camp further north in peace while the battle is still raging. This lack of discipline naturally puts the Archbishop of Cologne's side at a disadvantage there. Duke John I also recognizes this and, despite being outnumbered on the central wing, sees an opportunity for a counterattack. Yet this, too, proceeds rather sluggishly. So, by midday, the battle is now at a stalemate. At 1:30 p.m., even though I'd like to debunk all the clichés of a medieval battle as seen in films and on television all the time here, a truly clichéd scene does now unfold. Henry, Count of Luxembourg, who is determined to secure the Duchy of Limburg through this battle, catches sight of John, Duke of Brabant, and just like in an action film, albeit not without a few setbacks, as the path is blocked by battling knights and dead corpses, the Luxembourg Count makes his way towards the Brabant Duke, and they even take off their helmets and their swords and their lances, and the two of them simply, you have to believe that, they both engage in a classic one-on-one duel, just like in the school playground back in the day. So they punch each other with their bare fists. Both begin to grapple and beat each other up. Mind you, this is whilst a battle involving some of 12,000 people is raging all around them, with people risking or even losing their lives in the power struggle on behalf of one of or the other of the two combatants. But the wrestling match does not last very long. There is no clear winner, and the general chaos of the battle separates the two once again. The battle rages on. It is not only the loss of human life that is tragic. Some knights lose one or two horses in the space of a few hours underneath the body. Financially, the combatants have no qualms whatsoever about stabbing the animals in the hope that the rider on top will die in the fall that follows. The Count of Luxembourg alone loses his first horse when the Duke of Brabant's brother strikes it on the head with a mace. Although it survives for the remainder of the battle, it is so badly injured that it will eventually die. Duke John of Brabant also loses two of his horses during the fighting. The importance of banners in maintaining morale and order in battle is demonstrated here on several occasions during the battle. When the black banner bearing the golden lion falls to the ground, the troops assume that their duke, John of Brabant, has fallen. Only at the very last moment is a mass rout averted, as one of the duke's men picks up the duke's banner and holds it aloft once more for all to see that everything is fine, let's continue murdering each other. Do you remember when I said that among the nobility, one does not actually kill one another in battle? In the chaos caused by Archbishop Siegfried's maneuver at the beginning, in which he swung his right wing into the center, this no longer applied. Count Henry of Luxembourg once again attempted to force a duel with Duke John I of Brabant, as he did before. The latter, however, retorted with some trash-talking, calling the Luxembourger a coward. And then the tide turned slowly. The brother of the Count of Luxembourg, Warham of Luxembourg-Ligny, fell dead from his horse suddenly. This, in turn, sent Henry of Luxembourg and his knights into a rage as they sought to avenge his brother's death. Things went horribly wrong. The Count of Luxembourg's half-brother, who, as it happened, was also called Henry, was killed in the process now as well. So, two Luxembourg nobles dead. The only problem was that he was the standard bearer, this brother, also called Henry, for the Luxembourg coat of arms. The red double-tailed lion fell to the ground, and with it the morale of the Luxembourg knights. Horrified but not discouraged, Count Henry of Luxembourg charged towards the Duke of Brabant to revenge his two brothers, but he would not reach his target. Blinded by rage, he failed to notice that a Brabant knight was behind him. The knight plunged his sword into the Luxembourger's back and, as I said, was really a bloody nightmare, for not even the body can be recovered later on. The body of the Duke of the Count of Luxembourg is literally trampled beyond recognition beneath the hooves of the hundreds of horses deployed here for the battle. Another half-brother of Henry of Luxembourg, named Balduin, also dies. And with the death of the four brothers, an entire generation of male Luxembourgers died out at that point. Had they not already had children, the Luxembourgers, whose great heyday in the 14th century was still to come, would have died out north of Cologne. At that time, the son of the fallen Count of Luxembourg, Henry, was a child of around 10 years. He would later become even emperor of the Holy Roman Empire as Henry the Seventh, so another Henry. Why do they always give each other the same name? So far, we haven't learned little about the Brabant White Ring, or rather the left wing of the Archbishop's forces. Here the troops from Jülich and Lourdes on the Brabant side faced the army of the Count of Geldern on the Archbishop's side. Yet something strange happened here too. As I said, part of the Geldern army had absolutely no desire to fight. They broke away from the rest of the left wing and, having bypassed the battlefield, attempted unsuccessfully further north to plunder the Brabant camp. As a result, they were absent from the actual fighting. Despite the deaths of the Luxembourg commanders, the Battle of Worringen continued unabated into the afternoon in the center. Archbishop Siegfried von Westerbo continued to fight against the Brabant knights. The fact that he was an archbishop was at that moment quite inconceivable to us as modern observers. As a nobleman, well versed in mounted combat, Siegfried also took an active part in the killing. As the Brabant right wing is under control now, following the partial withdrawal of the Gelder's army, forces under the Duke of Brabant's brother are withdrawn from there, from the right wing, and deployed to the left flank to press the Archbishop of Cologne. And they achieve what had previously seemed impossible. They managed to put significant sections of the Archbishop's army to flight. And now comes another moment straight off an action film with a cliché. Do you remember how earlier, at the beginning of the battle, on the left flank of the Brabant side, the peasants from Cologne and the Count of Berg had initially fled after being the first to come under attack at the start of the battle? Unfortunately, Jan van Helu's account tells us nothing of what they actually did between 11:30 and now in the late afternoon, but they probably fought their way north to their own camp, regrouped briefly, tended to their wounds and freshened up, and are now returning at 3 p.m. to the left flank of the Brabant forces that was previously their spot. Anyway, and united, they strike at the rear of the Archbishop's army. Just to recap, at the start of the battle, the Archbishop had completely overrun his enemy's left wing, putting them to flight, and had then focused solely on the center. That came back to haunt him now. However strong knights may be on horseback, if they are attacked from behind, with no room to maneuver, things don't look so good for them. The Archbishop's knights are deprived of their offensive power and mobility by the general melee, and the mountains of corpses on the battlefield and the Burg peasants are absolutely livid about the losses they suffered that morning. They couldn't care less about the chivalric honor and are hacking to pieces everything that gets in their way, so they are not taking prisoners, as it was custom normally. The initial disadvantage of being foot soldiers has now been completely negated by the circumstances just described. Anyone sitting on a horse is pulled down and killed. The citizens of Cologne are busy helping the Burg peasants in their killing spree. And, oh people, war's really bad. Here we come to another tragic figure. None of the military commanders on the Brabant side loses his life that day. Whereas on the Archbishop's side, as we already learned, an entire generation of male Luxembourgers perishes. But on Brabant's side, at the end of the battle, there is one exception. Cologne, the city, is now able to inflict on its own Archbishop, the unwelcome lord of the city, the defeat needed once and for all to finally wrest the city from his grasp. He and his 60 fellow patricians from the city of Cologne decide to join the Cologne militias on foot. Gerhard Overstolz is the leader of the patricians. Whilst the monk Walter Dodde incites the Bergish peasants to fight, it is Gerhard Overstolz who does the same on the Cologne side. He, Gerhard, the son of Matthias Overstolz, who was killed exactly 20 years earlier at the Battle of the Ulrefelde, sees his historic moment has arrived. He will be the one liberating Cologne from the Archbishop. He dismounts from his horse and, together with the peasants from Berg and men from Cologne, he charges on foot the Archbishop's knights, who, trapped in the thick of the battle, stand no chance. But before he even reaches the first enemy, before he can even make his first blow with whatever he has, mace or sword, Gerhard Overstolz collapses to the ground, being dead. According to historical sources, his knight's armor was too heavy for fighting on foot, that is, without a horse, and the patrician therefore died probably of a heart attack. And so Gerhard Overstolzen dies, shortly before the greatest military victory ever achieved by the citizens of Cologne without any enemy intervention. Of course, this does not alter the outcome of the victory in any way. It is tragic in some kind of way still. Cologne and Berg peasants fought their way right up to the large colorful flag cart of the Archbishop, which stood out as the center of the battle on the Archbishop's side. The Archbishop's black and white flag was torn down, and with that, for everybody to see, the battle came to an end around 5 o'clock in the afternoon. For this was a clearly, literally visible sign to everyone that the Archbishop's side had lost. A few vessels of the Archbishop continued to fight for a few minutes, but were then quickly overpowered and taken prisoner. This was also the case for the Count of Gelden, who initially tried to escape without his war horse and his tabards, which would have given him away because of his coat of arms. However, he was recognized whilst attempting to do so and taken prisoner by Brabant. Speaking of being taken prisoner, Archbishop Siegfried von Westerburg had fought heartily in the battle. After all, he was of noble birth, and he now invoked the customs of the nobility in battle. In the thick of the battle, he signaled that he was giving up, or, to put it more acutely, surrendering. He did so within the earshot of the Duke of Brabant's brother, who was fighting the Archbishop of Cologne here in the final stages of the battle. Siegfried von Westerburg was then taken prisoner, but was immediately handed over to the Count of Berg, who was, in fact, a vassal of the Church of Cologne. So, the battle of Worringen had lasted 6 hours. Its length speaks to the ferocity with which it was fought. Brabant and his allies, including the city of Cologne, had won, yet this was not a glorious victory as it is often said in pop cultural media in Cologne. Far too many had fallen on both sides for that. Just remember, at the beginning of the battle alone, many Cologne citizens died. The victors shamelessly exploited the situation still. All the bodies were stripped and left naked on the battlefield. It made no difference whether they were foot soldiers or knights, or even enemies or allies. When the following morning priests and gravediggers sought to bury the bodies, they could only do so in mass graves, as the dead were no longer identifiable because they were really naked, stripped naked. Everything was stolen from them. So, ladies and gentlemen, dear people, of course we will still need to discuss the consequences of the battle, both the immediate and the long-term ones, as well as some analysis. But we'll do that in a future episode, okay? I think that was quite a lot to take in, and yes, despite the brutality, I'm a bit sad from an academic point of view that we've now actually moved on in the chronology past the Battle of Worringen, because it took us so long to get to this battle, and it's such a key moment in Cologne's history. But let's leave it at that for today. The literature I used in this for this episode included Vera Torunsky's Die Schlacht von Worringen, so the Battle of Worringen, and Ulrich Lehnhardt, the Battle of Worringen, 1288 as well. Thank you very much for listening. I'm exhausted, as you might have noticed. The heat is killing me. I'm going to drink a few buckets of water now. Take care, recommend my podcast, and auf Wiedersehen.